This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Sure, there may be people who are flying drones over their neighbors' fences to snoop, but most drone operators couldn't care less if you're sunbathing naked. They're not trying to peer into your windows. They're trying to take pictures of their own house in anticipation of putting it on the market. Or they're getting a great aerial shot of that gorgeous sunset. Or they're commercial operators doing something even bigger, fighting wildfires out west, transporting medical supplies and equipment to rural locations in third world countries. After the 2011 tsunami in Japan, where the Fukushima nuclear reactor was damaged, drones helped monitor radiation and determine when it was safe for people to return to the area. Today on the show, we're going to take a look at drones and at some of the new regulations in place to ensure safety and order. Returning for this discussion are Jarlath O'Neill Dunn, Jarlath, director of UVM's Spatial Analysis Laboratory, which actually uses drones. Jarlath, it's a pleasure to have you back.
Thanks so much, Jane.
And John Budreski from AirShark, which is a company that does aerial imaging for industrial inspection. It's nice to have you with us, John.
Thanks, Jane.
Okay, so I just mentioned a couple of things that drones are being used for, some actually pretty cool uses. Can you give us a couple more examples of how people are using drones, either as individuals or as commercial operators, Jarlath?
Sure. So at the Spatial Analysis Lab, we're really focused on using drone technology to map, measure, and monitor, especially our natural landscape. And that could be doing anything from monitoring floods along the Winooski River, such as what we had in last February during that freak warm spell, to just helping some of our local engineering firms be more efficient and effective in the way they might map a site before they go to install solar panels.
Yeah, we have quite a bit of overlap from time to time with Jarlath's group. We're actually on Cape Cod quite a bit doing some coastal mapping where there's a significant amount of critical infrastructure behind the dunes or behind the beach that's being at risk from some of the sea level rise situations. So we're down helping the USGS do some research and the regional planning commissions look at some of those items that Jarlath mentioned, in addition to critical infrastructure like the cellular towers and communications towers as well.
When you mean that, you mean you actually send a drone up to look at the top of the tower and see if everything is still in place?
That's correct, yeah. Not only just to look to take pictures and video, but to create some accurate 3D models to figure out how high the structures are and the serial numbers of equipment and things like that. So if we get close enough with some of our higher-end cameras and have a dual operator set up, we can help the engineering firm inspect it safely from a distance instead of climbing up the tower.
So is that the issue? It's safety? Because you could send somebody up the tower, right?
It's safety and also speed. We can do about three towers in the time it takes to do one typically. So there's some economies of scale associated with what we're doing as well.
And in terms of doing something like monitoring for erosion on the seashore, is that, again, you want a drone because you don't want somebody walking around over there?
Yeah, so in some of the wildlife and national park units, there's sensitivity around not only drones in the air, but wildlife and walking on sensitive marshes. So we can quickly overfly an area and create a 3D map to figure out how much volume of sand is moving or accreting per year.
Jarlath, what about this idea, this fear that somebody is using a drone to snoop on you? I'm going to read you a couple of emails that we've gotten in advance of the show. Brownstein says, any drone flying over my property is shotgun food. And Maureen in Williston says, a friend of mine had a recent experience with a drone flying over her while she was in her backyard. It was flying about the height of her home, and it would zoom in and out of her, in and out at her as if teasing or baiting her. It left her upset and feeling like her privacy had been violated. When she contacted the police, she was told there was nothing they could do. They also said that drones can fly anywhere as long as they don't fly higher than 200 feet. And if she damaged it in any way, she could be arrested for property damage. What is being done to institute laws and protections for the general public against such incidents? So clearly people are worried about this idea that somebody's going to use a drone to basically spy on you.
They are worried, Jane, and I think drones, especially our perception of them from what we've seen being used in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we do have this perception of them as being spy machines or perhaps deadly machines. But in reality, drones are just one type of imagery that you're gathering of someone's backyard. We have dozens of satellites up there. Our state contracts planes to fly and gather imagery. You have Google streetcars. You could have someone with a webcam. If we think banning drones is going to give us a sense of privacy, that's really a false sense of security. And I think I'll turn it over to John.
Well, but wait a minute, because you're not making me feel any better. You're basically saying, oh, sure, people are snooping on you with drones, but they're snooping on you with a million other devices as well. Is that really – What's happening?
It really is the case. I mean, right now you have satellite companies putting up these things they called CubeSats, which are tiny, tiny little satellites. And these companies have a goal of imaging every single space on the Earth's surface every single day. And so you can imagine, at least with a drone, you probably know that the person flying that drone is nearby. And that's not true with the satellites. You never know when they're imaging you. But I will say that I think these foundations are grounded. And as the drone community, we've got to really try to be responsible operators and not do things that creep people out.
I hesitate to use this moment to suggest to you, our dear listeners, that you can call in and share your thoughts. I joke, but I know there are real privacy concerns, so maybe that's where you're coming at this issue. Maybe you have a drone yourself. What are you using it for? Are you the one who's taking pictures of those beautiful sunsets over Lake Champlain? Are you a commercial drone operator? How are you using drones? And what do you think the future of drones are? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. John Bedreski, you also wanted to chime in on these questions about privacy concerns and restrictions and rights.
Well, there are states and communities in the United States coming up with additional laws associated or variances with using drones correctly and really educating the public. So we're seeing more of that. And I think it's, you know, entirely acceptable. A lot of the regulations that we have been focusing on last couple of years has been, you know, the safety of the airspace and getting those commercial flights in and out of, for instance, Burlington. So now we're seeing privacy, but, you know, human behavior at the end of it is still the critical element that's going to take a bit of time to weave into this.
If somebody does fly a drone over our listener's home who says any drone flying over my property is shotgun food, is that person allowed to shoot the drone out of the air?
As far as I know, at least on a commercial drone, it's registered as an aircraft technically, so it would be a felony on the commercial side. On the, I believe, on the hobbyist or consumer recreation side, I believe it's probably against law as well. I'm not sure what that entails exactly.
And you're probably not going to know whether it's a commercial drone or a hobbyist drone flying overhead.
No, we're talking about small unmanned systems today, anything generally under 55 pounds and generally under 10 pounds. So, at once they're 200 feet in the air or 400 feet, which is typically our maximum ceiling, they're not very difficult to see. Granted, the buzzing can be quite annoying, but you're not going to see a tail number or an end number on the drone.
You know, I have a friend who posts a lot of drone shots on his Facebook page, and he's mostly using them as a hobbyist. And they're really pretty strikingly good images and videos that he's posting. So can you get a decent drone these days for a pretty cheap price that actually takes pretty great pictures? I see you both kind of nodding.
Yes, I mean, you absolutely can, Jane. I mean, John and I, on the sort of commercial and research side, are spending tens of thousands of dollars on high-end mapping systems. But for a little over $1,000, you can get a drone that's going to do amazing videography for you.
And people can just do that and do what they want with it and pop it up there?
That's correct. I mean, you know, you can go on Amazon and 24 hours later have a really high-quality drone for $1,000 or less today. So
yeah, and many people are probably going to get that around the holiday time.
Absolutely.
Again, we're talking today about drones, how they're used around here, and we're going to get into some of the new regulations about flying drones. If you'd like to add your thoughts, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Michael in Essex Junction says, I've been organizing drone racing events around the area for the last year. We typically have about 10 racers in each event. Our group is very firmly focused on safety. We always have permission to fly, and pilots must follow a set of safety regulations. Drone racing as a sport has the ability to be very inclusive. We've had pilots as young as 10 racing alongside the retired. One participant is confined to a wheelchair. In the air, our physical differences disappear, and we are all competing on an equal basis. Have either of you seen drone racing? That sounds pretty neat. Jarlath, you're saying yeah?
Yes, yeah. I certainly have. On our side at UVM, it's not something we've gotten into because we're really concerned with the data. But I think these organizations that are organizing these races and promoting sort of the responsible use of drones are absolutely wonderful. And I'll give a plug to John. John last week brought us all together from the drone community at Burlington International Airport. We had a chance to listen to the FAA, listen to sort of the drone racers, the hobbyists, and also the commercial and research community and come together to talk about some of these really tricky issues surrounding drones in our national airspace.
Is the drone community a tight-knit community? I mean, is that a real thing?
I think it's a massive community at this point. It's gotten, you know, incredibly complex and large, and the economic implications are just significant across the board for commercial operations to businesses that are using them like VPR potentially in the future, and then the research and development between hardware and software. So then you weave in commercial and recreational and hobbyists, and it's, you know, tens of thousands just in New England alone. So
let's go to Bob, who's calling in from Shelburne. Hi, Bob. Go right ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Great.
So I'm currently teaching a two-day vacation camp for students from the Shelburne Community School, third, fourth, and fifth graders. And this morning the kids learned about controlling a drone and the different applications, commercial applications, some of the things that you mentioned. And now the students are in the process of assembling their own drones. So when they're done with the class, they'll have a good understanding of drone technology. And they'll also have their own drones, and they will have learned how to fly a drone. And these are actually quadcopters, easy to fly. They can be used indoors and outdoors. They're not the ones that have to be registered with the FAA, since they weigh about a quarter pound each. But they're about 12 to 14 inches across, so they're a good size.
Bob, what do your students say they are most interested in doing with drones when you talk to them about this?
Yeah, right now it's just learning how to fly them, but I'm trying to get them interested in all of the technology that is available and how drones are used in the commercial applications. And we've actually watched some TED Talk videos that show how drones can be used and the different applications, and basically the work that's done to program the drones.
Well, Bob, thanks for calling in. I appreciate that. And I promise there was no collusion with this camp for the students, that we just happened to be doing the drone show on the days that they're away at this this workshop. But thanks for calling in, Bob. Let's go to Tom, who's calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Tom. You're on.
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
So yeah, I just wanted to point out that it's perfectly legal to stand in your backyard and throw heavy sticks up into the air. So you don't need a shotgun.
So throw the stick up in the air. But if you hit a drone, aren't you worried, Tom, that you'd be committing a crime?
No, it's actually perfectly legal to stand there and throw sticks up in the air. So if a drone happens to be flying into your stick, you could probably sue the drone owner for hurting your stick.
In all seriousness, Tom, is this something that concerns you, drones?
No, not very. I mean, not much concerns me anymore, but I'm just at that, you know, downward slope of my life, so it doesn't really matter.
Well, thank you for calling in. I appreciate your perspective. I'm sorry to hear that you feel like you're on that downward slope, but I appreciate your sense of humor and that you're listening. Let's go to Jackson in Orange. Hi, Jackson.
Hi.
Hi.
Sorry, just say you live in a private place, you know, and for reasons, so you have no trespassing signs around the perimeter. And so if someone walked in, literally, you know, if you got pictures of them, they're breaking the law, so you would call your law enforcement agency. Yet if someone, just say, had a big opening in there, you visited, had picnics with friends, and, you know, maybe you knew movie stars that nobody knew came into Vermont or whatever, and somebody's flying a drone in there, aren't they violating your airspace by taking pictures of you instead of walking in on the ground? Is there any laws against this with someone spying on your private place? I mean, the public with money can access some really good drones that are real fast, that have high-def cameras, and I'll get off the phone.
Jackson, I appreciate your call. Thanks for that. Jarlath and John, what about this? Is there a difference between walking on private property and flying something in the air over private property?
I'll just make a plug for the Before You Fly app and website that the FAA developed for recreational and hobbyists last Christmas, to have a quick reference in terms of, you know, where it's okay to fly and where it's not okay to fly, and obviously having the associated level of respect there. Obviously for commercial operators that, you know, we're talking about today here, we're showing up quite visible and transparent and planning. We're actually putting notices out in the newspaper sometimes with the community before there's an overflight of an area, just like they do with helicopters, or did when they first started using them for utility right-of-ways. So there's some interesting ways to alleviate that concern. But again, it goes back to human behavior and some of these other ones. And the national airspace is federally, generally public airspace. There's lots of classes of airspace, but it's generally managed by the FAA.
But when does that start? Because, you know, I'm in the airspace here where my head is. Is this FAA airspace?
Outside, yeah, anything above the ground outside is technically federal airspace. So there's this idea of preemption when towns or municipalities try to put on laws on the books without going through the correct procedures. Now, there are communities that are effectively working with the FAA to come up with guidelines.
Charles, what can you add? Because, you know, people are concerned here that, wait a minute, isn't this a giant loophole then? If I say I'm on my own private property, you cannot come and walk in. But if you want to fly a drone and you can see your drone and you fly it right up to me, you can come right up to my face and take pictures of me with it.
Well, Jane, my experience with celebrities and photos extends to being in the checkout aisle and seeing the cover of the National Enquirer. So I don't want to say I'm an expert on this, but this is just an extension of the issues that we've seen for a very long time. We've seen photographers with fancy telephoto lens be in a tree or in a property next door, grab pictures. We've seen people use helicopters or planes to do that, or maybe satellites. So drones are just another thing that we have to worry about. And I think when we look at these regulations and we want to come at this from a privacy perspective, we should think about imaging in general. And that imaging may come from a cell phone. It may come from a cell phone on a long stick. It may come from a photo, a webcam, a satellite, whatever. And that's true for law enforcement or private use. I think we tend to focus too much on drones because we have that sense that they're sort of creepy and can invade our space. But really, it's any imaging technology can do this.
We're talking today about drones. We've gotten into the privacy concerns a little bit, but there are also some new regulations surrounding who can operate a drone and how. And we're going to get into a little bit of that, as well as maybe the future of drone use. If you have a question that you'd like to share or an experience, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're focused on the rules surrounding drone operation and who's flying drones where and how around here. We're talking with two local drone operating experts, Jarlath O'Neill Dunn, director of UVM's Spatial Analysis Laboratory, and John Podreski from AirShark, which is a company that uses drones for aerial imaging. Do you use them? Maybe you hate drones, but maybe you're finding pretty innovative uses for them. Maybe they're involved in your business now. Have you rented out a drone? Are you using drone operators for parts of your business that you couldn't otherwise do, or that for safety concerns are made easier by an unmanned aerial vehicle? Our number, if you'd like to weigh in, is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Mark is calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Mark. Go right ahead.
Hey there.
Hey.
I'm Mark. I run a company, MR Design Works. I'm actually friends with John. But I just wanted to weigh in on the legality of drones and how effective a commercially available off-the-shelf drone is for cinematography, or for surveillance, rather, because they do have high-def cameras on them, but they are wide-angle high-def cameras. So the use of them for surveillance, unless the drone is specifically built for that, is really a moot point. They're really more for capturing wide, beautiful vistas than really focusing in on something. And the person who wrote in earlier, the fact that that she knew the drone was there harassing her, definitely the operator was doing the wrong thing. But that highlights how bad they are at surveillance. Where somebody with a big telephoto from a few hundred yards away, you'd never know they were there.
Mark, what do you use drones for?
I use drones mostly for photography and cinematography. And my company is really focused on building interfaces for monitors and for sunshades and things to basically help people doing that.
Cool. Thanks for calling in. Appreciate your perspective and your thoughts on some of our earlier conversation. Let's go to Frank in Moncton. Hey, Frank, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
So I'm curious about whether any efforts being made toward the noise that drones make, quieting them down, and also whether there might be any discussion about some quiet places that we might still enjoy, like state or national parks, where non-commercial use would be limited.
Frank, thanks for the call. John, what do you know about trying to make drones quieter?
Well, the national parks are a great place for, I wouldn't say using drones necessarily, but to look at how impacts like sound affect humans and wildlife and things like that. So there is a lot of research that goes on, and there's a lot of opportunities going forward to sort of figure this out more effectively. Right now over at Cape Cod, we have Coast Guard jets flying just offshore, oftentimes at training missions at like 500 feet, and helicopters and recreational airplanes where I used to fly, flying pretty much, 1,000, 2,000 feet, making a tremendous amount of noise. And the drones, the multi-rotors that have four or five or six motors tend to buzz quite a bit, and you'll hear them at 100 or 200 feet, definitely. Jarl has been using a lot of the lighter wing aircraft, which, at 200 feet, you don't even see or hear them necessarily as much for when they're pointed straight down, creating a map. So I think there's a lot of opportunities. But again, right now, you generally will hear the drone.
We had a conversation about drones several months ago, and there were some regulations that were in the works that hadn't quite been finalized yet. And obviously, since then, they have been finalized. And so I want to talk a little bit about some of the new rules surrounding drones. And Jarlath, I understand that one of the bigger changes is in who can actually fly a drone, as in what kind of certification you need to be able to fly a drone. Can you tell us what the new rules say?
Sure. Well, there's always been this two-phased approach where on one hand, you've got recreational users that are really don't have to follow that many regulations. And on the other hand, there's those of us who are using it for commercial purposes, research purposes, education. And before these new regulations came out, it was a real burden. You'd have to have a pilot's license. You had to petition for an exemption from the FAA. That's all changed now, and they've really simplified things so that you get this new UAS operator certificate. And honestly, anyone can go and take it at any FAA certified training center, and you get your certificate. And then you can fly drones for commercial purposes, providing you adhere to the sort of list of regulations, operating below 400 feet, staying out of controlled airspace, not flying over people who are not notified, all those types of things.
But if I get a drone for my birthday and I'm just flying it for my own personal use, I still don't need a certification.
No, you don't need a certification at all. You've just got to register that drone with the FAA. And I think this is where a lot of us who operate on the more responsible side and take a lot of effort into using drones for good and trying to be responsible as possible, we sort of get annoyed when you see these things on the news and you see a drone flying near an airport and it's some irresponsible operator who's ignoring all the laws, probably hasn't registered their drone and shouldn't be out there in the first place.
If people who are using drones for commercial use have to have a certificate to fly them and people who are using them for personal use don't, where's the line drawn exactly? I mean, even you can think of if I get a drone and I take a picture of my own house because I'm going to sell it and I'm going to, put that picture up on Picket Fence Preview, I'm flying this drone for my own use. But if my realtor, who's a small-time realtor, has a drone and she uses it to take pictures of all the houses she's selling, is that commercial use? I mean, where are the lines actually drawn, John?
Yeah, there are some caveats for educational use as well as emergency response use. For natural disasters and things like that. But the commercial, anytime there's an exchange of potential monies involved, either at the time or for real estate, maybe later when there's a transaction, that would be construed as a commercial use of UAVs right now. So,
are there any other provisions in the new regulations, John, that you think are important to highlight? I mean, there are some rules you mentioned. The actual height that you can fly a drone is 400 feet or a little bit higher if you're on the top of a building and you're flying from there. Anything else that's worth highlighting?
It's allowing companies like us to scale up and have pilots that aren't rated to fly helicopters or airplanes necessarily, but they're equipped and they go through a training program. So we're able to now scale the business, which is helpful. And there's also something called waivers, where in the past there was a kind of a arduous procedure. It would take 6 months or 10 months to get approval to operate in Class C airspace or at night or beyond line of sight. So now there's a case-by-case sort of system right now. And in fact, I know Burlington Airspace is being charted out parcel by parcel within the Class C airspace. So it'll be easier for them to approve or disapprove operations depending on how far from the airport it is.
What are the rules surrounding airports and how you can fly a drone near an airport? Because I know that's one of the concerns that people have, is that drones are going to get in the way of commercial aircraft that's actually trying to land or take off.
Yeah, the airspace is pretty fascinating because we take it for granted. We don't see the airspace, obviously. Like, you don't see contours on a map when you look up the sky, but it's a very complex system. It's essentially 5 miles from an airport is sort of the no-fly zone. With some caveats there, and that Before You Fly app has great visualizations of when it's okay and not okay to fly. And most airport managers, as long as you let them know, they can put out a little notice in the morning that there's going to be a UAS operation 2 miles to the south or something like that. So it's just communication is key.
Let's go to Eric, who's calling in from Castleton. Hi, Eric. Go right ahead.
Hi, guys. I have just started to subscribe to Drone 360 and wondering if you had any other recommendations on literature that people can get to research this and become aware of what they're doing before they purchase a drone. I mean, these are really little pieces of technology that I've avoided buying because I know that they're going to come way down in price and go up in functionality. And as a photographer of 40 years, you know, some people are good with respecting people's spaces, and amateurs typically are willing to just cut right in front of you. And I think that's kind of a carryover into what we're seeing with drone operators right now. You know, learning how to be respectful.
Eric, thanks for your call. Appreciate that. Jarlath or John, do either of you have suggestions for people who are just coming to this, publications to read, how to get into it?
Well, I think John and I probably both are struggling to keep up with the rapidly changing technology sector, which drones are part of. Things are getting smaller, they're getting lighter, and it's almost every week we see sort of new major developments in the drone sector. Honestly, I try to do everything by social media, and I follow a select group of folks on Twitter, and that's how I try to do my best to stay abreast of these developments.
But Jarlath, you're also teaching people to use drones and, you know, as sort of part of your work with the Spatial Analysis Laboratory. Can you talk a little bit about how students are coming to you and what you're finding in this work that you're doing that relates to using drones?
Yeah, for us, it's really exciting. I mean, we've always used aerial and satellite imagery to map our natural resources here in Vermont. And drones finally give us a way to have our own system that we can get out there, fly it when we want to, collect the data that we need at the appropriate resolution, and make these 3D models. And what really excites me about being in the educational space is that people come at drones from different goals or different interests. Some person may come at it because they're really interested in the engineering, building a drone and flying it, and the aeronautical mechanics of everything. And then we'll have other people that may come at it from an interest of using the data because they can more effectively map wildlife habitat. And I'm really proud of our drone team at UVM because we have a really great mix of young men and women. And you don't see that when you go to a lot of these drone conferences. Quite frankly, it's just a bunch of guys out there. And I think as the drone community, we have to be aware of that perception. If it's a bunch of middle-aged guys showing up and flying drones, we sometimes look a little bit creepy. And I think our drone team, which reflects better what society looks like, which is a combination of young men and women using this technology to help Vermonters, really sort of sets the tone for the good use of these drones.
John, what do you think about the future of drone use? Where is this going? I mean, we even got a note from a listener, Gail, in Elizabethtown, New York, who says she's elderly. She wants to get a drone to be able to check out her property, her fences. She's just sort of coming to this, but, you know, says, oh, maybe this is a way for me to be able to see my property without busting my legs trying to get around it. She's got 35 acres.
Yeah, it's easy for me to look at the analogy with, like, medicine and visualization of big data in terms of MRIs and CAT scans, and we're in a controlled environment in a lab, or digital pathology. And now with some of this technology, we're taking it out and we're looking at our critical infrastructure under the microscope a little more effectively to make those decisions without having to replace an entire bridge structure, for instance. We can look for some corrosion or some rust in areas that maybe saves taxpayers' dollars. So it's interesting going from, you know, what's done today in the lab or in medicine, and all we're doing is sort of taking that out into the real world. But I think, yeah, Gail's got a great, you know, that's fabulous. I think it improves hand-eye coordination. It gives you some more functionality. It maybe allows you to go a few places in your backyard where you can't go or whatever. So there's lots of organizations she could probably become involved with as well online. So,
you know, and Eric said he mostly just hasn't gotten one yet because he knows that the specs are going to go up and the price is going to go down. Is he right about that? Is he hedging in the right direction?
I think in general, a lot of the, you know, the battery technology and the smartphone technology essentially from a decade or two ago is sort of going into the drones. So, you know, what was $10,000 or $20,000 is going to be, you know, $5,000 or $6,000 within a few years. But there's some other sensors out there that are just, you know, right today too exorbitant to absorb into the company right now to fly, but I think we'll see more advanced sensor technology becoming on board where we can measure like LIDAR or methane or whatever else we want to do. So there's, you know, there's no question it's coming down in general, but it's easy to reduce quality.
Yeah, because, I mean, you mentioned like measuring methane. Some of the drones that are out there, I mentioned at the very beginning of the show, like measuring radiation to see when it's safe for somebody to come in. We talk a lot about the imaging that drones do, but there are other things that these drones can do as well, right, Jarlath, beyond just taking pictures.
Absolutely. I mean, a drone is really just a platform and we can mount different sensors on it. It may be a camera, which is most of us do. It may be a camera that can see light that we as humans cannot see that helps us detect stress in vegetation or the health of vegetation for a farmer. It may be a laser on it that's eye safe that we can use to create detailed 3D models. Then as John mentioned, we may have sensors out there that can detect carbon dioxide or methane or perhaps radiation.
So it sounds like for both of you, this is a really exciting field to be in, but you're also saying there are still some things to be worked out with privacy concerns and regulations and airspace. And is that just because this is new technology and new at least for regular Joes to be able to use and we're still just working on it?
I think it's on many fronts, and the big thing is the regulatory front, and will the FAA be able to stay abreast of these technological developments? And a lot of the innovation, unfortunately, I think will happen overseas where people can do higher altitude flights beyond line of sights, delivering medical supplies to an isolated town. Those types of things you're not going to be able to do in America without some waivers from the FAA. So that's a big challenge for the community.
All right. Well, next time they come up with those new rules, we'll have you on again. Jarlath O'Neill Dunn is director of UVM's Spatial Analysis Laboratory. John Podreski is co-founder of AirShark, which is a company that does aerial imaging for industrial inspection. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thanks, Jane.
Thanks, Jane.
Coming up, the local history of a regiment of African-American soldiers who were stationed in Colchester, Vermont, 100 years ago. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. You've seen them, those green historical markers with yellow-gold lettering that dot the roadways around Vermont. They're how you learn that the country's first normal school, a school to teach teachers how to teach, was located in Concord, Vermont. There's also one pointing out the spot where an 11,000-year-old beluga whale was unearthed in Shalott. Laura Treishman is a historic preservation officer for the state.
What we're looking for are markers that will commemorate events, sites, people, the birthplaces, buildings associated with individuals, groups, or events, rare or exemplary examples of architecture or master builders. We really just want markers out there to educate people and to carry on the heritage and the history.
There are now 230 of these markers around the state. A new one went up in Fort Ethan Allen in Colchester last week, with a second one to be added in the spring. The fort is now populated with apartments, college housing, and a number of businesses, including VPR. But from the end of the 19th century until 1961, it actually housed United States Army troops. And from 1909 to 1913, that included an African-American regiment called the Buffalo Soldiers. That regiment can trace its roots back to 1866 when it fought for the U.S. in the Indian Wars. Lore has it that they earned the nickname of Buffalo Soldiers from Native Americans out of respect for their tenacity in battle. This new historic marker at Fort Ethan Allen commemorates the history. The Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity was part of the group that worked on getting the marker placed. Curtis Reed is the Vermont Partnership's executive director, and he told VPR's Rick Singeri how the Buffalo Soldiers were received when they first arrived in the community.
Their arrival here caused some consternation by some town folk in Burlington, which wanted to pull out Jim Crow laws, keep the troops segregated. But fortunately, the city and its citizens would have none of that, given the state's strong history on civil rights. But it was actually the free press that was that opposed the troopers from coming. Out of an irrational narrative that, black troopers were destructive and they were wild and dangerous, and none of that was true. And in fact, everything was to the contrary. They had an exemplary record while they were stationed in Vermont. The other piece to that sort of hysteria on the part of the Free Press was the fact that 750 black troopers was going to substantially increase the black population of 25,000 residents. And ultimately, it was probably about 1,500 that came because, you know, he had wives and kids and, you know, all of the regiments, both black and white, you know, had sort of a trailing group of folks that followed them around. So, you know, the apprehension that, oh, all of a sudden we're going to have this blossoming black population, and that we need to be fearful of, at least from the Free Press, was totally unfounded and never, ever realized.
Did the residents of Vermont take to the Buffalo Soldiers eventually?
Yes, very much so. And, you know, there's sort of a funny story around sports, you know, that the Buffalo Soldiers were great baseball players and basketball players. And at one point, their summer games in baseball were keeping people from the church. And, you know, the chaplains and the pastors of the day, you know, sort of approached the commanding officer at 40th and Allen and asked if the games could stop so that their parishioners could return to church. The commander at the time said, no, this is Sunday and we don't tell our troopers what to do on Sunday. But he was countermanded by one of his superiors. But there was a really lively sports scene, both, you know, in the wintertime with basketball. Also in the wintertime, they did several displays of their horsemanship at the fort, you know, for the general public. You know, they were all around good Burlingtonians for all said and done.
What was their role in the war effort?
Well, they fought in several wars, and they distinguished themselves first at San Juan Hill with Theodore Roosevelt, with Teddy Roosevelt. They also fought in the Philippines. They fought in Mexico. They were actually right after they left Vermont to go to the U.S.-Mexican border, where they were stationed for, you know, about 15, 16 years after that, I think. So, you know, they were a good fighting force, and they were known as the Fighting 10th.
In 2009, there was an anniversary celebration that was held in 40th and Allen, and many of the descendants of the Buffalo Soldiers attended. Did you hear from them any stories about these soldiers?
I was also at that 2009 celebration. And, you know, the sort of over-the-top glowing pride of being associated, of having one of your ancestors who was a Buffalo Soldier was a real hallmark. And I have to say that, you know, for the, you know, other black troops that were sort of specialized, like the Tuskegee Airmen, also come to mind as being a venerable source of pride for African-American families who had members in those branches of the military.
Two new markers have been placed in 40th and Allen, which is in Colchester and Essex, these new historical markers. What went into getting those placed in the fort?
Well, it was a year-long process of approaching you know, the state with the idea that, you know, we need to commemorate Buffalo Soldiers as part of the Vermont African American Heritage Trail, and the two historic markers are points 20 and 21 on the trail. There's a growing need, I believe, for Vermonters to know that black history is interwoven with Vermont history, and that, you know, the presence of the Buffalo Soldiers here, Also, I don't know if you were aware, but you know, after the flood of 1927, segregated Civilian Conservation Corps troops came and built the dams in Barrie after the 1927 flood. So, you know, these are points of information that, you know, let Vermonters know that we might be the whitest state in the nation, but we've also been, you know, a state where Black or African Americans have contributed vastly to our to where we are today.
That's Curtis Reed, Executive Director of the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity, talking with VPR's Rick Singeri about the Buffalo Soldiers. They were an African-American U.S. Army regiment that served at Fort Ethan Allen in Colchester from 1909 to 1913. A new historic marker commemorates their service. A second will be added in the spring. Learn more about state historic markers located all over Vermont at our website, vpr.net. We've been hearing from many of you about our discussion last Thursday about gender politics in the era of Trump. Our executive producer, Patty Daniels, joins me in the studio now to share some of those comments. Hello, Patty.
Hi, Jane. So listeners will remember that we invited a really diverse group of five women to put some issues on the table, some opinions and their experiences. And it was a really riveting hour of discussion. And if for some reason you didn't catch that show on Thursday, please go to VPR.net or to our app, listen to it in the podcast. The show is called Ladies, Let's Talk. One of the listeners we heard from is Diane. She wrote after the show, "Thank you so much for your program today, and please continue to keep such informative and touching stories front and center as we move forward. It's so important to give voice to these issues, and as I listened, it helped me understand my own reaction to the election results in a much deeper way."
We got a note from Matthew who says, "I'm very sad to hear all the women speak of all sexist behavior they face. As a white male, hearing this will make me more carefully watch my language and behavior."
And another male listener, Francis in Mount Holly, says, "One silver lining of the Access Hollywood tape was that it opened up conversations between husbands and wives. When it first came out, my wife started to tell me about her teenage experiences traveling daily on the New York City subways. After being groped a few times, she quickly developed street smarts to avoid it. For me, this revelation proved my naivete, and it brought to the fore the need for men to be more aware and vigilant about what women face on a daily basis."
Kylie writes, "Before and after the election, I've been hearing women in Vermont, young and old, say things like, 'Boys will be boys,' and 'Men always talk like this.' Is this where we are as women? Defeat and acceptance of patriarchy and sexism? I can't wrap my mind around these attitudes."
And Mary adds, "There's an expectation that women in positions of power, regardless of how qualified, must always, quote unquote, be nice. I'm deeply saddened by the ability of so many still to overlook and or be comfortable with blatant sexism and misogyny."
We asked for and heard from Vermont women who voted for Trump. Among them is Mary in Hinesburg, who says, "Yes, I voted for Donald. Even as I typed that, I realized people might hate me for that. Let me say, I am pro-choice and pro-life. I believe restrictions must be placed on abortions at the stage when the baby could be born viable. I believe healthcare belongs in the healthcare system. I believe Planned Parenthood has abused their powers. They are lobbyists. I hope people can accept I am a woman, not alone, who voted for Donald Trump."
Meanwhile, Rachel in East Burke calls herself a liberal Democrat, and she writes, "The gender equality movement seems to be focused on making women as represented in the workplace as men. How is this possible when a large percentage of us want to be mothers first? Traditional women's work is important, too. Intelligent women do choose to be stay-home moms. And I wish the liberals did not make that a cultural platform that we shouldn't want."
And Christina says, "I really enjoyed this discussion a lot. I think it was one of the callers who called attention to Obama's statement that he was, quote, proud of Hillary, which does sound patronizing to me. But you know what really sounds weird? Jane, introducing today's guests as really smart women. Would you have said really smart men or really smart Latinos? I think women are the only minority that still puts up with this. Food for thought."
Well, Christina made that comment online, and one of our guests, Jessamine West, responded to it, and there's an interesting back and forth there. And I'll just add, from my perspective, we use that description really to not set apart these particular women from other women, but to set apart this conversation from some of the other chatter we've heard in other places that just didn't feel very illuminating. But your comment, Christina, and a lot of the others we've heard have given us a lot to think about. So we do appreciate your feedback.
Yeah, it's always important to think about the words we use and how they're going to be perceived. And Christina, I did appreciate your pushback on that. I think I would say really smart men. But I do think, you know, the words we use matter today as in every day. And so we all appreciate all of the comments that you give us. Please keep them coming, as well as your ideas for future shows. What do you want to hear? We're on social media at Vermont Edition. You can also email vermontedition@vpr.net. Patty, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
A lot of the state woke up today to a covering of snow. For some valleys, it was the first snow of the year. Tomorrow on this program, we'll look at the weather. We saw a dry summer and fall with low water levels everywhere. But how could those conditions change as we head into cold winter weather? Tell us how you've been affected by drought conditions in the last months. Did you observe low lake levels or encounter a dry well? Tell us. Write to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening today.